Welcome to the Femi Pod. These conversations are for women runners that go beyond running. Brought to you by your Femi founders, Lydia O'Donnell and Esther Kewen. Back to the Femi Pod for episode 141. It is great to be back here. Hopefully you all listened to last week's episode with Dr. Izzy. This week we are doing part two of returning to running post-reds with the incredible Sarah Widdowson, our Femi dietitian who specializes in sports nutrition and hormonal health. And she is a long-time advocate for fueling female athletes properly so they can thrive not only in sport but in life too. So Sarah, it's been a long time since we've had you on the podcast. Welcome back. How are you?
I'm good. 141 episodes. That's crazy.
Yeah, as you said, the same thing. It's just funny because we have been chipping away in the background. I mean, the podcast has been running for a few years now and we don't have great consistency, but the numbers are racking up and there's a lot of conversation, a lot of content and a lot of
A lot of content, yeah. 141. Yeah. Very cool.
How are you going though?
I am good. I'm good. As you were saying, talking about Sarah's a big fan of people running and eating well. I often start like sessions with clients with Red S, which is what we're talking about today. You know, have you heard of eat pasta, run faster? Like I feel like that kind of summarizes, you know, what we should be talking about. But no, I'm really good. Happy to be here.
Yes, totally. Eat pasta, run faster is definitely one of our key slogans at Femi. And Reds is obviously something that's really quite close to our team and our community. It is something that we see a lot of female athletes and women fall into, unfortunately, just because of the nature of running and how taxing it is. So we're excited to really kind of get into the nitty and gritty of nutrition around Reds today. Last week, we really covered like the medical side of Reds and we went quite deep into what Reds is and how to recover from it and the signs that you should look out for in terms of like the physiological signs. But yes, today we're going to talk more about food and energy. So from a nutritional perspective, Sarah, can you talk us through kind of the pathways that lead to Reds?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm sure, I'll know the answer to this when I listen to Izzy's episode when it comes out, but I'm sure she covered that basically what we're dealing with energy deficiency in sport is not meeting the demands of your training and other needs of energy expenditure. So in young females, it's also like growth and development, but also the exercise that you're doing from day to day. So just, you know, moving around in your life, not necessarily the planned activity like the running. And the energy intake is obviously really important. So we're wanting to close that gap of energy disparity. So, I mean, I think the best way for me to answer the question is when I meet a client that has Red S or suspected Red S, which has been referred to me, the first thing I'm looking at is what are the, I guess, evidence points in their diet history that might put them at risk of Red S. So some of the things that I see might be, I guess, just an unawareness of what your requirements are. I think a lot of runners are hobbyist runners. They're not professional athletes. We obviously use the term athlete really affectionately and really loosely, but they're adding in that running load to their already quite busy lives where they might be working full time, they might have a family, and nutrition's just kind of further down that priority list. I also look for things like exclusions of food groups. So not every plant-based runner is going to have Red S, but if you are vegan, vegetarian, if you just favor plant-based eating, your fiber intake is going to be really, really high. And often those plant-based foods are much lower in energy, your calories, than animal proteins and animal fats. And so what happens is you look at these diet histories and these women have big volumes of food on their plate, but the fiber is making them feel physically fuller quite quickly, and meaning that they're not hitting that calorie demand to maintain their stride and their running. So looking for things like that. Diet extremes. I think what's really tricky about nutrition is, you know, the science is still evolving, but also trends move quite quickly. So things like, you know, this year, you know, you've got clients fasting. Do you remember paleo when that was like really cool? Like a couple of years ago, keto's kind of had spotlight. Now protein is like the kind of it girl in the nutrition world, and protein's great for us, but it's not more important than adequate carbohydrate, adequate fiber, plants and things as well. So watching for nutrition trends that are kind of popping up in diet histories. Does that answer the question?
Yes, definitely. I think it's interesting because I feel like I've been in both places where I have had disordered eating behaviors because I've had, pressure on myself to look a certain way. And I like definitely had body image issues where I was restricting my diet because of that. But then I also feel like I've been in that place of like just not eating enough because I haven't been aware of it. And it hasn't been like a conscious thing. And I think a lot of us can kind of fall between two. Unfortunately for us women, we have grown up in a society where there has been a lot of pressure put upon us around the way that we look. And we've seen a lot of disordered eating behaviors come off the back of that, unfortunately. But yeah, even as a runner who you might feel like you are like 100% doing all the things right, but still not eating it enough. We spoke with Izzy around the physiological signs of what can happen when maybe you're falling into a state of REDS. But can you speak more specifically about the gut and what can happen to the gut when you are in a low energy availability state?
Yeah, so what Izzy probably spoke about is when a body is deprived consistently long term from adequate fueling, what happens is it kind of has to categorize and rank or hierarchy where it's going to spend the energy that you're giving it. So Izzy would have spoke about how, the exercise is often maintained until it's not, your cardiovascular system, your circulation system, so that delivery of oxygen around your tissues is often really prioritized. And I always find it really fascinating that your digestion is actually not. So it's further down that priority list that your body's spending in terms of calories, but also that inadequate eating can impact on gut function. So particularly if you're skipping meals, that can impact on your gut function. Our gut has its own circadian rhythm, which is quite interesting, and in that people tend to digest better when they eat more regularly and have more maintained eating patterns. So as an example, if a client had started to trial fasting and they were restricting the top half of their day with eating, you'll often see more problems with things like constipation or bloating. Then from like a kind of like deepening looking into the gut, the nutrition that you eat plays into things like the development of hormones, which help with digestion, blood supply to your gut, which helps with digestion, your gut microbiome. So this kind of ecology of gut bacteria that live in your large intestine, they have a huge role in things like immunity, hormone health, and gut function. And kind of to put it really bluntly, if you're not eating or fueling yourself, you're also not fueling them. So they tend to be impaired by REDS, and that can also impact gut function. Another comment I'll make on gut and REDS is, those symptoms of like bloating, feeling full quickly, constipation. Sometimes women aren't aware that's actually a sign of REDS, and then they go on this pursuit of, well, now I must be intolerant to something. So maybe they'll like take dairy out of their diet to try and ease their symptoms. Maybe they'll put themselves on something called a low FODMAP protocol, cut out gluten, but you can kind of see the trap they're falling into, hey? Like it's a calorie and a nutrition inadequacy that's causing the gut issues. They're feeling crappy in their body, bloating, not digesting food well, so they cut out more food groups when they're actually kind of just worsening and perpetuating. It's also really hard when you're working with a client with REDS with digestion issues because you want them to eat more, right? And you want them to feel comfortable in their body. And so there is a little bit of an element of trying to manage those symptoms of constipation, sometimes nausea, bloating, while you're kind of healing and closing the energy gap can be a big challenge.
Yeah, it's so crazy because we spoke about this as well, but I'm like, when I had REDS, I actually was putting on weight because my body is in such a state of stress. And then because I was putting on weight, I had this thing in my mind saying, well, you need to restrict your diet more because you're putting on weight. But actually, I just wasn't fueling adequately. And so my body was just kind of holding on to everything. I find the microbiome and what you were speaking about, the bacteria that live in there, incredibly interesting. And I For my little pea brain to understand it, I remember back in the day, someone explained it to me like your gut has these kind of like little, let's call them bacteria, that live in there and they feed off carbohydrate. And those bacteria are the ones that make your food get digested and you get energy from your food. And if you're not giving those little bacteria carbohydrate, they're going to go to sleep. And so they're not actually digesting any of the food. And for me, that was a really easy and simple way to understand why I need to eat carbohydrate. But what is it about carbohydrate that's just so important for our gut, especially for women?
Yeah, I mean, so carbohydrates, so as an example, things like starchy vegetables, like whole grains, oats, even carbohydrate and things like chickpeas, pulses, and lentils, they're a really important source of fiber, right? And fiber is a just a different word for prebiotic. Prebiotic means food for your gut bacteria. So not only is carbohydrate for athletes, particularly with REDS, it's really important for hormone function, for that hypothalamus signaling, which gets you to ovulate, which helps to restore your period if you've lost it with REDS. It's really important for like replacing that glycogen stores in your muscle, we joked before, eat pasta, run faster. It's important. Like, glucose powers literally your running and other brain and functions in your body. But also from a gut point of view, it's really important for that gut bacteria who have, as I mentioned before, that really big role in digestion. So it's a fiber thing. It's a nutritional adequacy thing. So getting those calories back, it's a glucose thing, which is really helpful for closing that Redis gap too.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So let's talk more about preventing getting into Redis. But I think probably the recovery from Redis in terms of nutrition is probably somewhat the same as preventing.
Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong there. But let's maybe talk about both of those as a whole in terms of what things should we be focusing on in terms of nutrition to either stop us getting into Redis or coming out of it.
So when I'm working with clients who are runners, there's kind of like two areas of their nutrition that I want to focus on. So the first is that baseline nutrition. So what is happening during your day with food? Are you managing fueling before running and after running? So what's your kind of pre-exercise nutrition looking like, and what's your recovery nutrition looking like? What's going on during the day with eating? Are you managing to have like a well-balanced lunch? Are you getting in snacks? So the first thing I focus on is this idea of regularity. So making sure that you're eating often enough is really, really important. It helps to stimulate appetite pathways. And again, what I think is really interesting is often when people aren't eating enough, they're actually not hungry. Our body's suppressing some of that metabolism and appetite regulation. And so we want to bring that back online to help close that energy gap and in short, just get clients excited to eat again. So that regularity is really important. It's obviously hard to give specific advice on how often because it depends on where you're training, but making sure that you're fueling your run. I think a lot of people are, you know, like their long run on a Saturday or Sunday, they're like, yep, I know I need to eat something before then. But during the week, they often get up and they run fasted, which is often the first thing that I close. So ideally, for anything less than an hour, I want at least 15 to 20 grams of carbs there. So, you know, like a medium banana, a piece of toast with banana and peanut butter is another kind of really easy, manageable option. People will say, well, I can't eat and run. It's something you've got to work on and train your gut to do and kind of become a non-negotiable. I think it's a really good skill to have as a runner, is to be able to eat and go for a run. Then in terms of that recovery nutrition, you're wanting to make sure that you're getting in enough protein for recovery and enough carbohydrate to replenish that glycogen stores. Again, not everyone with Redis is intentionally restricting. Sometimes it's just you go for that run, then you're jumping back into your other responsibilities in life. So maybe you've not been organized with a packed breakfast to take to work or to school. On the weekends, maybe you've got a full social diary. So you do your long run and then kind of hope to just grab something while you're out and about, and it never happens. So getting really intentional with that recovery nutrition is important. Across the day, if I go back to that idea of regularity, again, it's making sure that you make time for lunch. I talk about this idea of the rule of three. It's like a really easy thing to communicate. So when you're plating breakfast, lunch, dinner, you want to have a carbohydrate source, a protein source, and a color source. So making sure you've got those three representations on your plate is really important. The other kind of strategy I talk about with that baseline nutrition is trying to lift your calorie intake really carefully, but really impactfully as well. So I mentioned before the impact that Redis can have on the gut. So if we kind of think about this problem of you need to eat more, but your appetite might be low, and you know, you might feel full quite quickly or feel really bloated from what you're eating. I find using fat-containing foods really helpful because they're more energy dense than any of the other food groups. So more energy dense than carbohydrate, more energy dense than protein. So if I wanted you, Lydia, let's say I want you to have an extra 300 calories the first half of your day, I could either ask you to have three extra pieces of toast, which you'll probably look at me and think, fuck, how am I going to fit that in? Or I could say, okay, well, why don't we add, you know, like a tablespoon of peanut butter to your breakfast? There's 80-ish calories. Let's add a tablespoon of tahini through your yogurt at morning tea. There's another 100 calories. And at your lunch, let's make sure that you've got a half an avocado there. There's another 200 calories. So we kind of lifted that calorie count without displacing other meals in the day because you're too full. It's not an overwhelming volume of food. And I think that's a really important strategy to use. I think kind of, I know that I'm rambling a little bit, but some of the other things I zoom in on, kind of going back to that carbohydrate piece, we have researched that it's not just about calorie adequacy, but also adequacy of carbohydrate in Redis. That's really helpful for recovering from Redis, particularly when it comes to that digestion and that cycle returning. So having adequate carbohydrate, if you think about the needs of carbohydrates for a runner, it helps to communicate to your brain to release the hormone luteinizing hormone, which is like the trigger shot that stimulates estrogen production and therefore ovulation. So those carbs help you to make a hormone called leptin, which is a fullness hormone, which signals to your brain, more specifically your hypothalamus, that you're eating. And then you'll have that release of luteinizing hormone as a reward of, oh, she's got adequacy of nutrition, she's got access to resources, I'm going to let her ovulate. So it's a really common thing I see is in the clients where their relationship with food is a little bit more complicated. They might be happy to kind of eat more vegetables, as an example, eat more protein because it's a cool thing to do. They might be okay with healthy fats, but sometimes there's this belief about carbohydrate that pops up, and I think that's a really important one to zoom in on. After you've kind of helped someone with their baseline nutrition, I think it's really important to look at obviously what's happening during the running. And as you would have talked about, recommendations with guidelines, with exercise, with readiness as well. But basically understanding what are your fuel needs during running, what are you training for, what's your ideal training load, and making sure that you're getting the adequacy during their running. So kind of starting with that 30 grams of carbohydrate per hour of exercise. This is for like a half marathon, marathon athlete. Some people need more than that. Depends on your training load as well. Helping people to navigate tolerance of fueling with exercise. A lot of people kind of have this narrative that they, don't tolerate fueling while they're exercising, so they just go without. Or, you know, like I'm fine. I seem to manage to finish my training with a smile on my face even without fueling. And I always say to clients, wouldn't it be so interesting to see what your body could do with a bit of nutrition? If you're feeling okay, what if we got you feeling great? And usually it's just kind of coming up with strategies to help with, like I said, the tolerance. Really interestingly, clients who underfuel often tolerate fueling during the running less. So again, helping that baseline nutrition is really, really helpful for managing, you know, your eating and drinking while you're actually exercising.
Yeah, it's funny. I have a male, actually one of my male athletes that I'm coaching at the moment, and he's an incredible athlete. He trains so well and he's actually run a really good marathon, but he's never taken gels on his run. And I'm like, wow, can you only imagine what you achieve by bringing some nutrition into your run? I think that's, it is crazy how little a lot of people know, but it's not their fault. It's just an education thing. So it's good that we're having these conversations. Brilliant. You've already answered my next question around like the people know. It was really good. And I think so important. It's like, how can women who naturally have a menstrual cycle or should have a natural menstrual cycle and have lost their period because they've fallen into reds, get their period back through nutrition? And you mentioned that carbohydrates kind of like the main food group to be focusing on to bring back in. Is there anything else from a nutritional point of view that women who are trying to get their periods back should hone in on?
Yeah. I mean, like if I could kind of think about what I usually talk about with clients, it's avoiding fasted exercise. So making sure that you're fueling for your training session is a really important one. That carbohydrate adequacy and everyone's requirements are going to be slightly different, but I'm usually aiming for about 4 grams per kilo of body weight split across the day, to put that into perspective. Making sure that carbohydrate is happening, not just in their baseline nutrition, but as we've just spoken about, during the exercise, and particularly with that recovery as well, I think it's often overlooked. And then it's the adequacy of eating, which I know is a complicated thing to answer individually, but it's making sure that calorie intake is sufficient and that it's sustained at a sufficient level for long enough to have that cycle return. Like a common question I get is like, when is my period going to come back? I've like kind of capped my training load. I've changed my nutrition. Where is it? And Izzy talks about this kind of waiting room phase or this patience phase where it's about maintaining the adequacy of eating and that, I guess, like responsible exercising, respecting the rest day in your training programs as an example. It can feel like a really hard slog for women to wait for this period to come back. So I really like asking clients, like, what else are you noticing coming back online for you now that you've kind of healed that energy disparity? So are you more regulated with your mood? Is your performance while you are training, is that better? Like, is your, your personality coming back online? Is your digestion better? Are you sleeping better? Is your iron deficiency healed? Like, there's all these other things that we get to celebrate before that period comes back. And I think that's really important to keep women encouraged and to kind of keep up with the hard thing, which is kind of having that ceiling of exercise and feeling like nutrition's become a little bit more prescriptive.
Yeah, I really love seeing women who I've known to have a struggle with disordered eating and maybe have fallen into reds. And then they heal from that and you see them one day and they just have this like glow about them, and
I
you're like, oh my
know.
God, I'm so happy, because you can just tell that they are fueling properly and they're feeling better and they just have that life back in them. It's like
Lovely.
really rewarding to be able to see that. From a more specific micronutrient point of view, is there anything that's really important to focus on when it comes to recovery from REDS?
As we probably spoke about, the bone kind of risk complication of REDS. So because of that estrogen suppression, which is happening because ovulation's turned off for a lot of women with REDS, it compromises your bone health. So because estrogen is involved in that remodeling of our bones, and our bones are under stress when we exercise, women with REDS, it's often actually physios who pick them up first, because they're presenting with recurring injuries or suspected stress fractures or kind of overuse injuries. And so you really kind of want to make sure that we're looking after your bone health for a recovery point of view. So calcium is a really important micronutrient that we're wanting to look at. Calcium, often people will think about dairy products, which is really abundant and rich in calcium. But there is lots of calcium in plant-based foods, like tahini is a great source. Tofu is an amazing source of calcium as well. Tinned fish, if you'll eat it, is another really great source. It is really important to be conscious around. I often use almonds as an example. So most women need about 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams of calcium per day. If you were to have like a glass of milk, you'd get 400 milligrams, 500 milligrams of calcium. That's almost half of your daily requirement. If you have a handful of almonds, you're getting 30 milligrams of calcium. So it's kind of just like putting it into perspective that you can't have a handful of almonds for afternoon tea and think, tick, I've hit my calcium intake. So calcium would be like a really important one. If you're someone who's vegan, plant-based, or dairy intolerant, I would definitely recommend working with a dietitian or nutritionist working in sports to make sure that you're getting the adequacy for that bone recovery and bone repair. Then we talk about vitamin D. So again, most people will think about calcium when it comes to bones. I think the dairy industries have like a really great marketing with that. But we need to remember vitamin D. You actually need vitamin D to absorb calcium and to help with that calcium lay down in your bones and preventing that stress fracture as well. So getting your vitamin D levels checked by your sports physician, your general practitioner is a really good idea. I routinely recommend supplementation in my clients in New Zealand, so particularly across our winter seasons. I kind of teach this idea of when daylight savings ends, start a vitamin D supplement, and then when daylight savings begins again, you can kind of come off it as you've got that more sunlight exposure. It's obviously amazing that we've got all this information around skin cancer prevention and we want to honor that. But obviously, with being covered up, using sunscreen, sunblock, kind of dressing appropriately, it does put us slightly more at risk of vitamin D deficiency. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't wear sunblock. It means that you should be aware of your levels, making sure that you have safe sun exposure, and that you are looking at supplementation over winter. I think it's a really good thing to do. Then iron would be kind of my last answer to that question. So one of the other side effects of REDS, so one of the other symptoms we often see, sorry, is iron deficiency. Because of what's happening in your gut with the REDS, likely the overtraining that's going on, and likely the undereating that's going on, you become more at risk of iron deficiency. Once you're deficient in iron, you need a supplement to recover from iron deficiency, and then it's about preventing deficiency levels. So I don't know how much you want me to talk to this, Lydia, but there's lots of advice that I could give there. If you are on iron supplementation, and you're kind of navigating a REDS journey, often again, gut tolerance can be a big problem. So people don't tolerate iron supplements that great. There's lots of different versions of iron supplementation, and some forms of iron are a little bit more digestible than others. I'll often talk about actually reducing your dose. So doing iron supplementation every second day can be really helpful, not only from an absorption point of view, but helping with some of that gut distress as well. And I often say to my clients, if we're thinking about prevention of REDS and thinking about prevention of iron deficiency, if you are a really active female, getting your blood levels checked of your iron stores every 6 months, I think is really appropriate. And you can kind of start to see that ferritin or store of iron fall nice and early. And we can capture it early, make some tweaks to your nutrition, maybe do an over-the-counter iron supplement, which can make a big difference as well.
Yeah, I've actually been using a new iron supplement, which this is totally not sponsored at all, but it's called BioBlend, and it's an Iconic Iron, and my iron has gone from average, I would say around ferritin 20 to 25 my entire life, sometimes even lower, and it's gone up to 50. So
Amazing.
it like And I think it is quite good on the gut as well. Like, I've never really had issues with iron supplements because I've been on them my whole life, but I do feel like it is working, which is incredible. So I think the supplementation industry is like an interesting one. I feel like we get questions about it all the time, like what should the place products to use and which aren't. But I think especially if you're coming back from something like Reds, trying to do whatever you can to like help that journey is good. I know you're not a psychologist, but you work in a clinic and you work with a lot of women and a lot of female athletes. And I know the mental struggle that goes on when you do have to start increasing your diet and bringing in more calories. And what do you kind of tell your clients and how do you guide them through that process of getting them to eat more food when they kind of have this fear, I guess, of food?
Something that I often explain to clients when they first sit down to me is I draw this very uncomplicated image of a circle, and that circle represents kind of your comfort zone with food, right? And often when they're coming to work with me, they're in their comfort zone. So I could draw an X right in the middle of that circle. I talk about how my job when I'm working on your relationship with food is to push the edge of that comfort zone. So then I draw an X on the line of that circle, as opposed to doing something that's really different, really confronting, really anxiety inducing for your relationship with food, which is like an X marked all the way off the page, right? So my idea is to kind of be pushing you and supporting you to make change. I use science to do that. And I actually find that runners are a really motivated group to work with because they want to get back to running. They want to heal from their stress fracture. They want their period back so it doesn't happen again. They don't end up in a moon boot again. But I think them understanding my job is to push, but not to terrify. Yeah. Then I often will ask them, often people with a complicated relationship with food will kind of categorize, even if they're not aware of it, you'll hear them talk about what I would call their safe foods. So foods that they eat with lots of permission, happy to do it, not afraid of the portion. I don't get any kind of noise or body image distress when I eat those foods. Then they'll have a list called conditionally safe. So you'll often hear them like, oh, on a long run day, I'll have toast before a run. But in their diet history, you'll see them not having anything to eat in the morning at all if it's not a long run day. So it's foods that are there and they're happy to eat them, but there's kind of some subtext or some rules about them. And then there's their fear foods, stuff that feels really scary, lots of body image distress when they eat them. When I'm kind of initially working with them around a meal plan to heal from the energy disparity with Red S, I use safe foods and I use the conditionally safe foods, yeah, rather than kind of using the fear foods. And then what happens over time is when you start to heal the adequacy of nutrition, there's really good research that it helps to reduce the eating disorder voice, yeah. So once you get that adequacy and that regularity using the safe and conditionally safe foods, it's really interesting watching the list move. So the fear foods will move into the conditionally safe foods. The conditionally safe foods will move to the safe foods. And you'll kind of see the safe food list, you know, they stop favoring, you know, just vegetables on the plate. They get excited to eat other groups. So it is a little bit of a journey. I often focus on like, what are you gaining from this experience? Often there's an emphasis around like, yes, I want to heal from my Red S, but I don't want to gain weight. It's like a big narrative that women will have. I personally don't weigh clients in clinic because I think it adds to their body image distress, but we talk about like non-weight related victory. So what else is happening? I mentioned better sleep. So often in starvation states, sleep becomes really dysregulated, and that's not never a nice thing, right? How they feel during the exercise, watching their biochemistry change, so like the sex hormones coming back online, or watching their iron deficiency heal itself as well. So getting really clear on like what else are we celebrating, because the eating disorder voice will say, you know, you're gaining weight, but you can kind of counteract it with what else am I gaining? Yeah. I think referring to psychology is a really good idea. Often that body image distress becomes like a really big part of the conversation, and there's so much that my scope can take my clients, but there's other things that I think psychologists are the absolute powerhouses on, and having someone on that team, particularly someone who understands working with athletes or people who like to exercise, I think is really important. We're lucky enough to have Lottie at FME, who's an example of someone I refer to in Christchurch. Because she totally gets the psyche of a runner, and how to support them through that.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like that's why running's so powerful because you can see the results of it, you know, like
Totally.
you start fueling better, you actually start feeling better in training, you actually start performing better. there's this like really beautiful positive feedback loop if you can get it right and get that flywheel start turning.
Yeah.
But I do know those first steps are quite terrifying and scary. So I feel like everything you said is really powerful and I know will help a whole heap of women as well. Is there anything else that we've kind of missed in the nutrition and ready space that you wanted to talk about today, Sarah?
I mean, you'll hear me say this every time that we do one of these, is that nutrition is such an individual science. It's a really complicated thing to give, advice for a wider audience. But I hope the kind of myth busting or the bubble popping around like the carbohydrate, looking at it's okay to be vegan or plant-based, but, you know, you probably do need extra tailoring and support to make sure that you're getting enough and understanding your needs. Like, you can be a hobbyist runner and still need different nutrition than someone who's not a runner. Being okay with eating, navigating your relationship with food. There's lots that we've kind of flirted with today, which I hope has been helpful. And I think if you are someone who's suspicious of redness, I think our intuition as females is often overlooked, but you are the expert on your body and your relationship with food and your experience in your body, right? So I often ask my clients, like, do you think you eat enough? Like, imagine everything you do in a day. Are you happy with what you eat? Would you be happy if someone you really loved and you took care of? Would you be happy if they did the same on the food that you're having? And usually that gut instinct answers the question. It's usually a really confident, no, I'm not happy, I'm not doing enough. And that creates that honesty, helps us kind of take a step forward. So I'd ask that to everyone listening, like, are you happy with what you're doing with food? Doesn't mean that you have an eating disorder. Our relationship with food is complex and it sits on a spectrum. And not having an eating disorder doesn't mean that you're not worthy of care and support in this space either.
It's exactly what, as you said as well, you know, like, it is complex, it's complicated. We're all so individual. And even myself, I was saying, I've, you know, been running my entire life pretty much, and I still make mistakes. Like, I remember seeing an Instagram post quite recently, and it had the amount of carbohydrate, I guess it was probably more like of a general runner, what they needed across a day. And I was like, wow, there's a lot. Like, it's a lot of food that we need to be, you know, and I feel like I already eat a heap, but I definitely am not eating that much. So even I'm still learning. We're all still learning. So you definitely have to just go on the journey and, yeah, really like hone in and listen to your body and know what you need. Just to finish off, Sarah, what is one thing that you wish every runner knew about fueling and hormone health?
I think I would say, you know, that if you don't tolerate fueling while you're running, that we can do something about it. I think a lot of women, they just, you know, they don't like gels or they don't tolerate gels. They get runner's gut and like need the toilet when they fuel. And that just kind of becomes something they feel like they need to live with. But there's so much that we can do about it. We can train that gut just like any other muscle group that you're working on when you're running or when you're at the gym. So that would be my answer.
Yeah, I love that. It's all about conditioning. Running is about conditioning the body, and then fueling is about conditioning the body. And then over time, you just get better and better and better.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Sarah. What a great conversation. I can't wait to get this one out to the community. There's so much going on there. And we will tag Sarah into our show notes. You can go ahead and follow her and hit us up if you have any further questions on our Instagram at femi.co. But yeah, thank you so much, Sarah. I can't wait to have you back very soon.
Thank you.